You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where insomnia did not keep us up last night. I'm your host, Justin Wisniewski, and I'd like to welcome you to this edition of the Nolan Notes. Finally, we've returned to another edition of the Nolan Notes. We've already covered Following and Memento, and now we're going to direct. We're going to discuss the D.
We're going to discuss
always
the D.
Distracts people. Yeah.
Williams, like, hey.
We're going to discuss Christopher Nolan's third directorial movie, Insomnia. He did not write this movie. He only directed it, which I think plays into a lot of this here, but we'll get into that. First, I would like to introduce my two co-hosts, who you already heard both of them, joining me this trip from Dale's lawn for going his... It doesn't matter for this, so who cares? William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, I'm glad we're discussing this movie. It's been a while since I watched it, so I got to watch it again this week and enjoy it. So I'm looking forward to a hip discussion and some hot takes on this movie.
Also, returning to the show after a long sabbatical from wherever the fuck he's living now, James Elias.
I'm
still in the hills of white privilege. And it's really good to be back. I'm excited to talk about Christopher Nolan's movies.
I'm excited you're back, too, because now I get to make a drop of your laugh that I can use against Daniel during the news. So.
And to be fair, that is the number one thing people have missed with James being gone. They're like, I miss James's laugh. I'm like, nothing else about James in this?
I think that's their way of saying they miss him. I know.
I always like to start these movie specific episodes with just saying sort of what our experiences with the movie are. And I know both of you expressed to me this past week that you've seen the movie before. I've actually never seen Insomnia before. I had heard of it because this was supposed to be like Robin Williams' dark phase, which was a really interesting way to watch this.
Make sure you enunciate that one. Dark phase.
Why? What did I say?
It
Gaze?
Sounded like face. So,
his dark face.
Okay, dark phase. I apologize. His dark phase. And it was a really interesting way to watch from that perspective, because if you didn't know who Robin Williams was and you had like a disconnect from him, like, you know, it's been years since I've seen anything with Robin Williams because, you know, rest his soul. And I don't watch a lot of his older stuff. I just don't. I'm not a huge fan of his. He just seems sort of like a normal actor. Like, his performance wasn't that big of a deal. It wasn't even that remarkable in this movie if you didn't know who he was. So decontextualized, that was really interesting. And also decontextualized, if I didn't know this was a Christopher Nolan movie, it wouldn't really have come across as a Christopher Nolan movie. You can tell he didn't write it. You can tell he directed it, because I think he did his damnedest to make visually uninteresting material interesting visually. So you can tell it was him in that perspective. But in a way, it was just sort of like a typical cop mystery movie. And my first reaction when I started watching it was, this is like Hannibal, but not as interesting. You know, Hannibal is, you have Will Graham and he goes to investigate all these serial killers, and he has to deal with, you know, am I a serial killer? Do I have the mentality, because of the special way that he thinks? And Al Pacino as Dormer plays this typical American cop hero who's very good at what he does, and he's against the current culture. And there's a lot of these themes or motifs that are echoed throughout films later on. And this was 2002, in the subsequent 17 years. So a lot of this feels very dated, and it doesn't hold up as well to me as other Christopher Nolan movies have over time. So, William, what was your experience with the movie?
Yeah, I remember going into this movie that I had watched it before, but I didn't remember too much about it. And So rewatching it, while I thought, like, I didn't realize that Nolan hadn't written it when I first watched it, but you can kind of tell within the first act that this isn't written by him, right? But even down to the music and the way the shots happen, in the way that they're, the way that, like, I'm thinking of, like, the chase over the logs and things like that, there's these little marks of little sparks of Nolan that shine through the movie that are pretty enjoyable. But it's not a bad movie, right? Like, the story's not bad. It's just kind of formulaic. But even then, it has some themes in it that are very Nolan themes, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that you could see what appealed to him about directing this movie. I don't know if the studio asked him to direct it and he agreed, or if he asked to direct it, if he pitched it. I mean, certainly since he only pitches doing, he's earned enough clout in the proper sense to only do stuff he's written and is directing and producing himself. But you can certainly see why this appealed to him, even if it was pitched to him because of the thematic content. James, what was your experience with the movie?
My experience is very different. I think I have a more positive view of this movie than both of you, and also more of a view that makes me feel like this is a Nolan movie. I don't think this was typical or formulaic. There's a lot of typical and formulaic aspects to it. You know, I mean, Al Pacino's character, Will Dormer, is the typical American cop hero. But there's this spin on it, is that he compromises, and that compromise continues to, like, eat away at him until it just fully catches up to him. And then near the end, we'll talk about that. But I thought it played on that really well. And in most, you know, cop thriller movies, you don't get this psychological aspect that you get in this movie. And so that's why it registered to me as, like, not being written by Nolan, but it's almost as though, like, parts of it were written by him. There's so much psychologically going on here, and the theme of what happens to you when you live out contradictions is fleshed out very well. And I don't know if anyone could do that other than Nolan. In our last Nolan notes with Memento, you see what happens when you have a literally fractured mind, and then you find out that his mind is fractured, at least thematically, by internal contradictions, and that comes out here too. So I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah, and that's a lot of what I was referring to when I was saying you can see how this movie appealed to Nolan, even if he didn't write it himself. And then, of course, in the production process, the director can make changes to the script. I mean, we know with Snyder, he actually literally draws out the storyboards, and they shoot the storyboards and not the script. So we don't know what sort of a process Nolan has as well, because I agree there were certain scenes that very much seem like Nolan scenes, even with the dialogue. The most notable to me is near the end when Al Pacino's character is talking to Maura Tierney's character. And I think we need to look at that scene in order to frame this whole discussion of the movie. But first, let me build to that so people have some context of it as far as what we're talk about, because I'm going to highlight the important things. So this starts out as a typical cop movie. And it's just sort of like, oh, these two cops from LA are going to come up to Alaska where they're in the season where there is no darkness. So people who are not
also known as summer.
Right. I was pointing out the fact that it doesn't even get in other places in the summer. It gets dark here. It gets no dark, and it doesn't. And then that place in Alaska, it doesn't get dark at all. There's no darkness.
Yeah, because the sun is so close to Alaska.
Right. So now that we've explained basic science. And
no,
basic
that
definitions.
Was not basic science. That was bullshit science. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go on. No, it's because of the tilt of the Earth. During the summer, the sun will never go down in Alaska because it's so near the North Pole that during the summer, the earth just, or the sun just goes around in circles in the sky. It never sets.
Okay. So now that we've also, I don't know. Can we just talk, fucking go back to my summary?
Go back to your summary.
Okay. So they go to this town in Alaska where it's always day. Okay. Even when it's night, it's day. There's no darkness. And they go to solve a murder because Al Pacino's character is friends with the cop there. But then it takes a little bit of a twist where there's an internal affairs investigation of the precinct that Al Pacino's character works in, and his partner is going to roll on him. He's going to roll on him because at a certain point, Al Pacino planted drugs on someone who was guilty, but he went, he didn't do it objectively. He didn't live in line with reality. He didn't do justice the proper way. He had to lie to get this guy convicted. And because of that, there's tension between them. So they track this killer, and in the mist, Al Pacino accidentally kills his partner, and then the rest of the movie is him trying to cover that up while also trying to track the killer played by Robin Williams. Well, later in the movie, Al Pacino not being able to sleep because of the lack of darkness, but also because of the guilt on his soul, this is where the title comes from, Insomnia, is just at his breaking point. And he talks to the woman who runs the inn, Maura Tierney, and he explains the whole situation I just explained to her. And he says to her, what do you think about this? And, her first thing is, I don't have a right to judge, blah, 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 because I'm a bad person too, blah, blah, blah. Side note here, I'd just like to point out that one of the ways you can tell that Christopher Nolan did not write this movie is her character is not integrated into the movie well at all. You can tell that she very easily could have been cut from the movie. Those earlier scenes with her didn't matter, but Nolan needed to keep her because this scene at the end is very important. So that lack of integration of her character is something that really demonstrates that it's not a fully Nolan production. But he asks her, Pacino's character, Dormer, asks Mortieri's character, what does she think about the whole situation, about him planting the drugs on that guy in the past? And she says, I guess it's about what you thought was right at the time, then what you're willing to live with. And this quote is very interesting because it seems to focus on the you, right? It's about what you thought was right at the time, then what you're willing to live with. Now, that seems to be more about rationalization and just hedonistic in a way, which almost making you feel better about yourself. So it almost becomes narcissistic or emotionalistic at that point. But then the ending shifts our perspective on this. So we have to look at the quote at the ending. So at the end, Dormer gets into a shootout with the killer. They both kill each other. And as he's dying, the local cop who was investigating, Burr, was the local cop who was investigating and had learned that Dormer killed his partner, comes to him and basically tells him that she will not let anyone know, basically cover up that he shot his partner, and sort of lie in the same way that he lied about the drug dealer by planting drugs on him. So she says to him, nobody needs to know. You didn't mean to do it, and I know that, even if you don't. And she goes, she's going to throw away the only evidence, which is a shell casing from the shell that was in her partner. She's going to throw it away. And he says, no, don't. And she says, why? And he says, don't lose your way. So the question is, does this uphold that quote by Maura Tierney, or does it contradict it? And either way, what are the implications on the heroic nature of Dormer's character? Is he redeemed at the end? Is he not? So, William, go ahead. Any thoughts you have on everything I just laid down there? That's sort of the frame for this discussion.
I don't know that the question of whether he's redeemed or not is even part of this. I think it's more of a learn from my mistake sort of lesson, right? I don't know that the redemption is really the point. I think it's, the path I took leads to destruction. Don't take that path, right?
Right, because it's important that he had to die at the end of the movie, right?
Exactly.
Because his planning the drugs on the criminal led to him fighting with his partner, which led to him having to cover up his partner's death because it would look like he did it on purpose, which led to him having to
trying to frame the killer, right? Trying to frame Robin Williams for the death.
Right, which led to him dying in that final climax. So it's important that he had to die because his faking reality led to him dying.
Absolutely.
James, what are your opening thoughts here?
I completely agree. I really like that cause and effect chain, and that cause and effect chain is present in the movie, and that is part of the objective content of the movie, and it's integrated from the beginning to the end, except this stupid quote. I think the quote is just straightforward. It's just a straightforward mistake in writing. It was just written in, like, the writer, whoever he was, you know, maybe he didn't get a good night's sleep that night, and he just put that in.
Maybe he had insomnia.
There. Yes, that's right. Yeah, see what I did there? So, yeah, something I've learned.
The quote you mean is Maura Tierney's quote, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the quote that the innkeeper has, where she says, "Yeah, it's what you're willing to live with," and you know, I've been, you know, it's just this stupid folksy wisdom that doesn't integrate with anything.
Well, can you pick apart
said.
A little bit what perspective you think that quote has philosophically and why you think it's disintegrated?
I cannot. And that's actually my point. I don't think the quote has philosophical content. This is actually something I've learned in the last years. As objectivists, because we are aware of the philosophical implications of a statement, that's what Rand taught us. She taught us the art of philosophical detection. Because we are attuned to that, we see it everywhere, and it is everywhere. You know, what she says does imply everything it is you just said, Justin. It implies emotionalism, it implies hedonism, it implies rationalization, it implies all of this. It's true. But that implication is just a logical implication of what she's saying. It doesn't mean that the movie or her character actually has any kind of philosophical content. There is no content. It's just a hodgepodge. Like, there was no attempt to integrate this statement into the rest of the movie, and the statement itself is just all over the place. So I don't think there is, you can't take it to have any content.
Okay,
it's just a contradictory
mess. There's an interesting thing that we can tease out of what you just said, and it's the difference between the character and the movie. Now, I don't think the character was trying to make some bold philosophical statement, and I don't think that the character was any sort of philosophical thinker. But oftentimes, a writer can put philosophical statements in the mouth of a character who's non-philosophical. And your argument is even that the writer wasn't intending to do that as well.
Yeah, this is just a slip up. You can't ask, like, why did he do that any more than you can ask, you know, why did Tom Brady trip that one time while trying to get away from a someone trying to tackle him? It's like he tripped. Like,
okay,
that's it. There is no deeper reason.
I appreciate your reintegration into the midside by using Tom Brady football metaphors, but how dare you? Tom Brady does not trip.
But if he did, there wouldn't be a reason.
Okay. But William, I understand what James is saying, and I think there is a case to be made for it. But this scene clearly stands out as a scene of importance. It was clearly put there to emphasize right before the final conflict here as sort of reflection on the internal struggle of Dormer's character. So wasn't the writer intending to have this be some sort of moral statement was happening?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think this was a clumsy way to get the exposition of the internal struggle that Dormer was having, but not necessarily a commentary on it. Does that make sense? Like, this was just a plot device, a poorly executed plot device to get us to get Dormer to tell us his perspective on what he did and what his guilt is.
Then why write that line in that way?
I think it was meant to mean something. It just didn't.
Yeah.
Like, he tried, like, the writer was trying to put something meaningful. Like, one thing he may have been trying to do here is the line about, you know, it depends on what you can live with. Maybe what he was going for was Al Pacino or Dormer then decides, well, I can't live with this. Yeah. I can't live with going against my job and valuing my job at the same time. I can't do that.
Yeah, I had the same thoughts. That line was the only one, like, it seems like we were meandering to get to that so that it emphasizes his choice to risk his life to capture, right? Like, he could have sent what's her name to go capture Ellie, the killer, right? Because that's the more mm-hmm. dangerous thing is, hey, I'll lay the cover fire, you go sneak up behind him, right? But he says, no, I'll do it. I'm making this choice here.
Yeah. And well, I think in a lot of movies generally, the writer has a feeling for what his theme is, but he hasn't explicitly identified it in philosophical terms. The theme here is that when you enact a contradiction, it will bite you in the ass. Like, it will come back to haunt you. And because the writer knows this, but he doesn't necessarily know why that's true, he will kind of mix in other elements, in this case, emotionalism. Oh, well, it depends on what emotional state you're willing to live with. It depends on not the actual answer, which is, like, have you thought about the consequences of being a cop who values truth, but then also throwing out what can be objectively proven when you don't like it? Like, can you live with the consequences? But he doesn't know the details of how that works in terms of cause and effect. So he's going to throw in unrelated elements. That being said, this was still well written. This was the only slip up, as far as I can remember.
I don't know. I'm going to push back on that.
The rest is very consistent.
Okay. I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because what you're saying really points to the fact that Pacino's struggle, Dormer's struggle through the movie, is really shown as emotionalism. Everything he's doing is he's reacting emotionally, and that's why he's shown as not being able to sleep. It's not about the guilt over what he's done. It's over the fact that he can't get away with it, and he's worried. That's how it's portrayed, and it comes across. I recognize what you guys are saying about the quote when she's saying, I guess it's about what you thought was right at the time. That's almost her character trying to sound smart, and it's just her reflecting him back to him, right? Because that's what he thought was right at the time, and then what you're willing to live with. That's, again, just reflecting it back. It's just she's just saying platitudes to him, because she doesn't know what else to say. So I recognize that. But then you take what you're saying throughout the movie, James, and it's very much an emotionalistic movie. I mean, even Robin Williams' character is reacting emotionalistically. So unless the argument is that Robin Williams' character is meant to be the foil to Dormer's character, so we can understand how Dormer is not acting emotionally as Finch is. Finch is the name of Robin Williams' character. So is that how you guys saw it? That Finch was meant to show how you could emotionally respond to this type of contradiction, and Dormer was meant to show how you could more rationally respond?
I don't think that, because it doesn't seem to integrate with the facts, like with all of it. It seems to me like what Finch's character is supposed to do is to show Al Pacino what happens when you go all the way with a contradiction, Finch just completely maintains, oh, I didn't murder her because I didn't mean to do it. It's just, I'm just going to bullshit myself on this.
I saw it as a almost a like a pattern, a sort of three-way like echo, right? You have Dormer looking at Finch and saying, learning, oh, I've made a mistake, right? Like, I've fucked this up, right? I'm pursuing this contradiction, and this is where it leads, right? That whole speech on the boat about he knows killers, right? Like, when he starts to see the contradiction and hear Finch's story of how he killed the girl and how it was a mistake, he internalizes that. Like, you even have the dialogue about him saying, like, I don't even know if I did it, or if I did it with malice or not, right? That's not the way he says it, but... I don't even know if it was an accident or not. And so you have Finch having Dormer turn back, and then you have Dormer telling the detective, I forgot her name in the story,
Burr.
Yeah, Burr, telling her to turn back, right? Like, look at where this leads you. It leads you to me. And then Dormer was like, look at where this, Finch was thematically saying, look at where this leads you. Look at me, right?
Yeah, I side with more that interpretation of it, is that it's the theme is what happens when you compromise. That's very explicitly worked out in the movie, but there's enough concretes that make that pretty consistent, and that's why it's a good movie, is because it is consistent in that way. But like anything else, there's, you know, it's not full, that theme is not fully explicitly identified, and so there's going to be these slip-ups, like the line. Though, Justin, you do have a good point when you say, when you raise the question, why is it that Dormer can't sleep? Is it guilt, or is it fear? I'm not sure. That's actually a good, I assumed it was fear the whole time, but now that you mention it, I'm not sure. It could just be literal guilt, like fear over being caught.
Right, so you're saying you assumed it was guilt, but it could be fear.
Yes. Did I accidentally say fear there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I meant I assumed it was guilt that kept him up, but there is evidence, it seems to integrate with the facts that it's fear that kept him up, fear of being caught.
Right, and I think that's an important point, because that would be the difference between him and Finch. And maybe that is the point, that at times you can't tell, but then ultimately it is his feeling of guilt that motivates him at the end to take the risk, and it results in his death, because rather than being fearful at the end, because, you know, he's a typical American hero, he goes against that fear and recognizes that he's feeling guilty for something he did wrong. So he has to, rather than continue to work with Finch, punish Finch, right? He has to make sure Finch dies for what he did. And maybe the whole point is Finch is operating off of fear. And that's what I mean when I'm saying emotionalism, because I recognize everything what you guys said is true about how Finch has fully embraced the contradiction. But isn't it the fear that has made him fully embrace the contradiction? So maybe that's the whole point, that when Dormer is tempted to work with Finch is when he has fully embraced the fear. That's what's more motivating him than the guilt and his sense of justice.
Is it, well, with Finch, is it fear or the thrill, right? Like,
one thing I'll remind you is that evasion or repression is not an evasion of a certain emotion, but the evasion of a certain fact. You might evade it in order to avoid feeling a certain emotion, but it's always the facts that you're avoiding, never an emotion.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, and what Dormer is avoiding is the fact that he is responsible for killing his partner, right? And he is responsible for ultimately planting the drugs on that cop, that he is guilty for doing that. That is what he is trying to avoid, not the fact that he feels guilt, but that what he did was wrong. That is the fact he is trying to avoid. Those things that he did is what he is trying to evade. Likewise, What Robin Williams' character Finch is trying to evade is that he killed that girl,
and he wanted that girl, and he liked killing that girl,
right? And that's what I'm saying. The fear is, I'm saying the fear is a result of that evasion, because what he's afraid of is he is afraid of being a bad person.
Hmm. is, yeah, he doesn't, there's no indication that he addresses his own moral status one way or the other until the end.
Who's he? You're saying Dormer or Finch?
Dormer.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Finch clearly avoids his moral status the entire time.
Yes.
but Dormer of, like, I mean, he doesn't, it's not, you don't see him evading it, but you certainly don't see him facing it in any real way. Every time Finch tells him, you know, Finch is always that devil on his shoulder telling him, like, oh, you did mean to kill him. You know, whenever he says that, Al Pacino simply just stoically deflects in that typical American cop kind of way. Like, oh, well, that's emotions. I don't need to, you know, really think about that. And so, right. I guess that's its own kind of, yeah, I mean, that is repression of the consequences of what he did. What is the status of what he did? We don't know. He's not thinking about
that. Yeah, and I love the concretization there by Finch's character, or by Finch saying, like, oh, that's not a good story, right? Again, back to the boat conversation, like, oh, no, we need a wild card. That's not the good story, right? Like, he's living in this fantasy world. He's living in his fantasy right now through this whole movie, right?
Right, 100% correct. And as you rightly pointed out, William, it was a great observation. Dormer finally physically, concretely addresses his sort of own moral status when he doesn't put Burr in the lion's fire and he goes and does that. You know, you cover me. I'm going to take the risk, because it's not her risk to take. It would be another
evasion.
Yeah, another evasion, but more blood on his hands if she was to take the risk and get hurt because of it. If she were to die because of it, that would be more blood on his hands. So yeah, he finally
It would be his way out too, right?
Right.
Like God damn it, I can't remember her name in the show. If the cop and Burr and Finch kill each other, then that solves his problem, right?
Right. And Nolan, with a darker ending, such as The Prestige, if he was writing, he may have done that to show that. You know, and then maybe it could have ended with him committing suicide or something. Nolan tends to like more ambiguous endings when we look at The Prestige or look at the ending of... I'm totally blanking. The reality one. With the top.
Inception.
Yeah.
Another eye.
Right. And that's why I got confused. Inception, The Prestige, he tends to like more ambiguous endings, whereas this ending was very unambiguous. Don't lose your way. Mm. You know, that statement in itself is telling us what just happened. It's explaining what just happened. I lost my way and this is the result of it. And he's telling her not to do the same thing. Because she's shown from the beginning, Burr, Hilary Swank's character, is shown from the beginning to be a good cop and a good person. Does anyone have anything else they want to add? I think that was a good discussion of the depth that the movie calls for. Does anyone else have anything? I know, James, you said you have a lot of notes. So does anyone else have anything else they'd like to discuss?
I had one more thing to cover, which I thought was really interesting, which is his moral status regarding planting the evidence on the criminal back when he was back in LA, that is clear cut. Then the fact that led to this tragedy, that's clear cut. But what isn't clear cut is the actual shooting itself. There's literal a literal aesthetic fog over the scene. He shoots someone. He shoots his partner in the fog. Based on the way they depicted it. I think it's pretty clear it's an accident. It's not like, you know, there was some, I don't buy that there was some Freudian part of his subconscious that wanted to shoot him. He was mad at the guy, but there was no indication that he was ready to kill this guy as soon as he was willing to kill Hap as soon as he got the chance. So that puts some level of ambiguity on this. The fact that he was put in a no-win scenario because he killed this guy on accident. And on one hand, if he admits to it, all of his case, he probably would get minimum, what's it called? He'd probably get some kind of minimal punishment. But there would be a question of, actually, I'm not sure. It's just ambiguous. Like, what would have happened if he immediately fessed up to friendly fire?
I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know the law of it, but I think pointing out the fog is very well taken, because I think the fog, James, represents what you've been saying. The fog is the cloud of what he did in his past over his ability to reason and see the situation properly. Because if he saw
the
situation
properly... Yeah, he put the fog there.
What? I didn't hear you.
Yeah, he put the fog there.
Right, he put the fog there, 100% correct. Because if he was seeing it properly, he wouldn't have been shooting in the fog. He would have said, this guy's going to get away, and we're going to get him later, because we're on to him, and we know who he is, and we can, you know, get more evidence. Because very clearly later in the movie, it was shown that that was his cabin. So they could have traced the ownership of the cabin to Finch. They would have gotten him eventually, and he would have known that. But he was so obsessed with punishing this guy and capturing him because of this guilt he felt over what he did in the past, that it made him have to try harder than he normally would have tried, which resulted in him killing his partner. And I agree that he didn't do it intentionally, but what happened was, when he went down to comfort his partner and Hap immediately accused him of doing it on purpose, is when he got confused and when he realized, fuck, this isn't going to look good on me. What do I do? And it all became evading what he originally did at that point. That's when he doubled down on everything.
I disagree with some of what you're saying, because based on the situation, like, he was firing. He could have been firing in self-defense, because Finch had already shot one cop in the leg in a sense, so he could have just, but the thing is, it actually makes sense that he got confused at his moral status, because he's already avoiding these, you know, psychologically avoiding these things he's done in the past. So now that there's this kind of straightforward case of friendly fire, he's not sure if it actually was. He's like, well, I know I did something wrong and I'm avoiding it. Maybe I did do this on purpose. And in my own experience, this is how repression works. Because if you're avoiding some kind of fact, but you don't know what it is you're avoiding, because you're avoiding it, of course. And so it kind of just casts this general pall over everything.
You don't think in the moment he was just thinking, fuck, somebody could think I actually did this on purpose? You think in the moment he was thinking, fuck, maybe I did do this on purpose?
I think the evidence of the movie says that, yeah, because later he is not, because there's no indication of what his opinion on that question is. Whenever he's asked, he deflects. Like, he's asked by Finch, he deflects. Whenever it comes up in any kind of way, he just doesn't address it until he's asked it directly by the person who's actually trying to find the truth, Ellie or Burr. And then he hesitates, and he just says, I don't know. That's what he thinks on the issue. And I think it would make sense if that was his feeling on the issue from the beginning. He's not sure, because, and he's not sure if he did it on purpose or not.
See, what's interesting
to me is already avoiding facts.
What's interesting to me, James, I see what you're saying, but when he said that later on, I thought that was a result of his insomnia, that he wasn't able to tell anymore, because his insomnia was that was the fog, and it continued and it grew until the point that it was, he couldn't think of anything anymore. So he didn't know what was true at all anymore. Whereas in the beginning,
yeah,
I thought that he was clear on whether he shot him or not.
Or why he shot him.
Right, right. William, what do you think?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I kind of more with James on this one. It's hard for me to get that deep into the characters.
What do you mean?
Forgive me for being. Oh yeah.
I just mean, like, it's on the psychology side. Like, this to me is fascinating. Like oh wow, you know, like. Even just like with Finch's character, it's like, wow. Like, to me, it's almost like a too hot to touch sort of psychology of a killer. And so there's a lot of this. I'm just listening and trying to understand what the depths you guys are getting to on this part.
So is that, would you say that's a result of the movie or a result of your own perspective?
I think it's maybe a little both, but more on the perspective side.
Interesting, because I think there's an argument to be made that the movie isn't clear enough on this point.
Yeah, I think there's a little elements of both there.
Yeah, it makes me wonder what the standards are of literary analysis here, because you know, the author, on one hand, the author thought this clear, or the writer clearly thought this through explicitly on some level, and he did it on a admirably deep level, but he didn't go as deep as you could have, and so there are these contradictions. But on the other hand, a writer's subconscious will make lots of integrations. He'll be able to, when he writes some line of dialogue that he's able to subconsciously notice, that doesn't really sound right. And like, subconsciously, the reason it doesn't sound right to him is because he's feeling some kind of contradiction with the rest of the story. So he'll change it. So there is a lot of integration here, but you know, it's hard to get into it. You know, it's hard to get into it. We're asking the question, for example, was Dormer confused about his guilt from the beginning, or was he only confused after tons of insomnia had weakened his mind? I don't know if there's an answer to that question or not. Yeah. I don't know if you can get that deep into it. On one hand, it seems like you can, because the artist created this reality, this very self-consistent reality, but it isn't completely self-consistent. So can you answer a question like this? I don't know. That's a real philosophical question of literary analysis.
Well, there's an answer to what you're saying, and I'm going to get to that in a second, because I think it's the best way to sum up this sort of episode. But I will say, I think as you're talking, what makes sense to me, and this might just be my writer brain, how to make the most sense of it, what makes the most sense to me is he feels guilty, but ultimately what he doesn't realize is what he feels guilty for is planning the drugs originally, and he doesn't come to terms with that until he's fully into his insomnia. And it's in that conversation with Maura Tierney, the innkeeper's character, that he realizes that what he feels guilty about is planning the drugs, and that caused the result of him accidentally shooting his partner. And that's why he doesn't know if he did it on purpose or not, because he doesn't know how much he fucked himself up by breaking his own code, by losing his way. And I think that's the point of the point of the final line.
I guess
don't
to
lose
say
your way.
To say it a different way, he knows he caused it, but what's his accountability for that cause, right? Was it a proximate
Correct.
Cause, or was it a, you know, first mover cause?
Now, as far as what James is saying, the fact that the movie doesn't answer that question is, I think, what ultimately shows that it's not a full Christopher Nolan movie, because he would have thought that through. He would have thought through all the philosophical implications, the psychological implications, and he would have demonstrated that in some way. And for me, that's why I'm not a huge fan of this film. I don't dislike it. I think it's better than a lot of what's out there. But when you're talking about a Christopher Nolan film, It's just not that strong to me. Now, as far as the three that we've seen so far, I think I'd probably say Following's the worst, then Insomnia, then Memento. What about you guys? How would you rank the three so far?
I agree with
that
order.
Yeah, completely agree with that order.
Okay, but I think as we go forward in the future Nolan notes, which hopefully we'll do more frequently, I think we'll start to see his films get more consistently better, especially since he's writing and producing all of them from now on. Mm-hmm. Any final goodbye thoughts, gentlemen?
No, I think that sums it up. If you have a suggestion for our next Nolan Notes, make sure to join our Discord, hop on there and let us know that you enjoyed the show, and let us know your thoughts on this movie, and then give us some suggestions for the next Nolan movie we should do.
I agree with that. A little plugging as well as with that. I think we raised some interesting points. And you can hop on the Discord and tell us what you think on some of these questions that I think we ultimately conclude some of them are unanswerable, which is a weakness in the writing. But what do you think? Do you disagree with us? Let us know in the Discord. let us know. James, do you have anything you want to plug that you've been working on? Any podcasts or anything?
No, not yet, but I'm continuing to work on my physics. I've gotten all the way to the year 1820 in physics. I started, if you remember, I'm working on a full inductive systematization of math and physics, and I started with cavemen counting rocks, and I've covered all the essentials of math and physics from prehistoric times all the way up till 1820. And now
post 1820, that's when you start to get into the dismantling of the patriarchy and the white supremacy among physics and math, correct?
That's right. Well, no, that's not until 1920. We don't have the dismantling of the patriarchy known as reality and objective reasoning. We don't have that until 1920. So I still have a lot of good physics to get through.
Oh, I was joking. I was saying that physics is terrible because it was peak patriarchy and peak white supremacy.
Oh, I see. Yes, the patriarchy will be alive and well for another 100 years of my research. So, yeah. And I may start a podcast on that, or there's a possibility that I join an education technology company to start working on inductive style lessons. And we'll see which thing I do.
Very exciting.
So that's my plug. Yeah.
Well, that's exciting. Thanks for stopping by. And thanks to everyone else for stopping by the Midside. I'm your host, Justin M. Lezeski, reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Way to step on it, Justin.